Welcome to another exciting episode of NID's Knowledge, this one being Real Space Strategy Edition. This podcast is produced by the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we will inform you about the latest in space strategy and its importance to our national defense. On July 30th, 2024, a United Launch Alliance Atlas V rocket lifted off on its final national security mission. This launch culminates over a decade's worth of work to remove the Atlas V from the space access options of the Department of Defense. With such a stellar success record, one might wonder why that would be the case. In this episode, we will explore the background on the reason for this, the Atlas V's engine, the Russian-made RD-180, and how our now successful movement away from our dependence upon it was achieved. But to understand this decision and the significance of that recent launch, we have to look back over 30 years to the end of the first Cold War in the early 1990s. During the latter years of the 1980s, the Soviet Union had developed a massive launch vehicle to carry its space shuttle Buran into space. This rocket, called Energia, leveraged a predecessor engine called the RD-170. This four-chamber engine was developed for use in the strap-on boosters for the Energia rocket. After this effort was canceled, the engine was made more efficient by scaling down the RD-170's combustion devices with half-size turbo machinery. After several successful performance tests and high-level agreements between the U.S. government and the now post-Soviet Russian government, the new engine, now called the RD-180, was scheduled to be imported to be used in U.S. rockets. The combustion chamber of the RD-180, which is a single turbopump unit, is fueled by an RP-1 kerosene liquid oxygen mixture and uses an extremely efficient high-pressure stage combustion cycle. The engine, for all you engineers and techies out there, runs with an oxidizer-to-fuel ratio of 2.72 and employs an oxygen-rich pre-burner, unlike the U.S.'s typically fuel-rich designs. The inexpensiveness of this engine, coupled with its thrust and combustion efficiency, led to the U.S. government pursuing this engine technology for our own strategic national security space uses. So you might be asking, okay, if the U.S. was the leader in space at the end of the Cold War, why should we buy Russian engines? Well, this is because at the end of the Cold War, the Russian space program was broke and unable to sustain operations, both civil and military, at any great extent. The concern by U.S. and allied leaders was that if a partnership was not seized upon with the Russian Federation space engineers, that other less friendly nations like North Korea, Iran, or others would seek to employ the Russian engineers towards a more destabilizing future in missile and space proliferation. So it was decided that given a Russians a way to team up with the U.S. in space would show good faith in our desire for peaceful partnership, but also would mitigate a potentially strategic problem set all wanted to avoid, which was the expansion of ICBMs. So as a result of this policy and acquisition shift, General Dynamics Space Systems Division, later purchased by Lockheed Martin, acquired the rights to use the RD-180 as part of a new evolved expendable launch vehicle program, and particularly their Atlas program. The idea at the time was to leverage commercial providers to have multiple launch vehicles at the ready to put up national security payloads should one fail, like was the case after Challenger in 1986. It was arranged that the RD-180 would be produced by Pratt & Whitney. However, it ended up that all production would happen in Russia within the Energomash company, through a joint venture between Energomash and Pratt & Whitney through another middle company called RD-AMROS. After its test use in a few earlier models of the Atlas, it was eventually became the main engine for the Atlas V. As time went on, the objective was set that eventually the RD-180 designs would be shared with Pratt & Whitney and a U.S. version would be created, thus eventually phasing out the use of Russian-manufactured engines. However, given the cheap cost of the engine, and its stellar track record of launches, the government, including Congress, continued to provide waivers of that requirement of transition to U.S.-made variant and continued purchasing these engines for the Atlas V EELV program. Now fast forward to 2014. The Winter Olympics Games are in full swing at Sochi, Russia. Everyone is focused on the Games and other events going on in the world. Then the Russians invaded Ukraine and seized control of the Crimean Peninsula. Due to this event, all of the plans and waivers and policy views of the past several decades came to a crashing halt. Calls were made by many in Congress, including Senator John McCain, then leader of the Senate Armed Services Committee, to cut off all reliance and technology sharing with the Russians. Space technology was just one of these, with the RD-180 engine being the prime target. Given the invasion, concern with the aggressive acts, and our financial support of such resources through our purchases of the engine, threats were being made on the Russian side to cut off not only the RD-180, but access to the space station on their manned Soyuz vehicles. Then Deputy Prime Minister Dmitry Rogozin was quoted as telling the U.S. that we would have to use trampolines to get into the space station area, given our reliance on their manned spacecraft and RD-180 engines. At that point in time in 2014, the shuttle had been phased out in 2011, and we did not have commercial crew availability at that point. So this was a new issue. For over 13 years since the engine was first used in the Atlas III in 2000, there was no serious jeopardy for the engine supply, they thought, despite the U.S. and Russian relations being challenging at times. But worsening relations following this invasion led to several mini self-imposed blockages and court discussions on whether the scope of U.S. sanctions covered importing Russian engines or not. As someone working on this issue as a consultant in the Pentagon, I can tell you that there were days when we thought that we had clear guidance, and then there were days when we were told to hold up, and all this happened on again, off again for a few days, and then eventually into weeks. On May 13, 2014, Dmitry Rogozin made a statement that Russia will ban the United States from using Russian-made rocket engines for military launches, a frequent use of the Atlas V. In response, the Department of the Air Force tasked the Aerospace Corporation to begin an evaluation of alternatives for powering the Atlas V with non-RD-180 engines. Early estimates in 2014 was that it would require 5 to 10 years to replace the RD-180, given the lack of new engine engineering and testing in the U.S. for many decades. One common misconception that Senator McCain and others in Congress had about engines was that, like a jet engine, you could just slide the engine out and pop a new engine in. The reality is, the Atlas V was designed for the RD-180, and the rest of the design was put around that engine. So in short, it would take a new rocket to replace the Russian engine, not just an engine itself. However, there was no shortage of opinions on ways forward, as think tanks and former space leaders wrote copious articles, reports, and commentaries on the issue. But keep in mind, this is before SpaceX's Falcon had become the frequently launched, reusable, and low-cost option for military and commercial payloads. At the time, most space professionals in government did not believe that SpaceX would ever be able to match the flight rates and mission assurance of the EELVs under the ULA umbrella. While looking back at how low the flight rates were and the cost of such missions, it certainly is a much different environment we find ourselves in today, with respect to space transportation, thanks to SpaceX and others in the commercial sector. But back to 2014, one of the many candidates that were being discussed for a direct replacement of the RD-180 was the Aerojet Rocketdyne AR-1. The AR-1 was, in concept, a 500,000-pound thrust oxidizer-rich stage combustion engine fueled by a combination of liquid oxygen and kerosene. The idea was to use two AR-1s to replace one RD-180. This idea did not seem to fly well with most, especially when the cost was shared with and the timelines. People in leadership were impatient. The Air Force, then running space, had been pushing with some success another effort known as the Hydrocarbon Booster Demonstrator, which was to be an American version of the high-efficiency kerosene engine. This was all estimated again, like others, to take 5 to 10 years to work. At the same time, SpaceX was deploying their Falcon 9 with their liquid oxygen kerosene engine, which in its first configuration was capable of generating 170,000 pounds of thrust per engine. At the time, SpaceX was not part of the ELV program, and the Air Force was not looking at them seriously given several reasons. One, SpaceX was a horizontally integrated payload and rocket system, meaning that it lays on its side when the payload is attached, whereas most payloads were designed for the United Launch Alliance style of vertical integration of payloads on top of the rockets when they're on the launch pad. So SpaceX sued the Air Force to let them compete, and this led to several Senate hearings where Elon Musk himself testified against his co-witness, the ULA president, on how the government was getting ripped off due to the cost of the Atlas V and Delta IVs. Eventually, SpaceX won and was allowed to compete and won the contract to be one of two launch providers with ULA. Despite many estimates showing that it would take decades for a U.S. design and produce engine, especially those ran by government programs for reliable access, SpaceX's successful entry into the mix was a tremendous lifesaver for the U.S. space program. In the meantime, ULA bought several more RD-180s during a waiver period to get through the plan manifest to ensure that planned national security payloads would make it up while SpaceX was getting approved for launches. Also, ULA made an announcement in September 2014 that while it was partnering with the startup Blue Origin, who had not launched anything into space yet, for their BE-4 methane engine. This engine would be placed on the Atlas replacement rocket, which they were calling Vulcan Centaur. It would be the only rocket ULA would have, following the retirement of the Delta IV and the Atlas V. This effort suffered from many delays, and the Vulcan still has not become operational, making some concern that payload's task for the Vulcan might have to be remanifested for SpaceX Falcon 9 or delayed. So, despite the success of SpaceX's engine and cheaper Falcon 9 for the civil, commercial, and national security space sector launch needs, some are now concerned that SpaceX, the company that many thought would go nowhere and would not be as cheap as they are now a monopoly. ULA certainly doesn't think so, but while the future looked grim and that the US would have no way to get payloads into space for decades, SpaceX really was a lifesaver given their development was underway at the right time to fill the gap. So now ULA is flying out the remaining RD-180 engines on the Atlas V. The last national security launch mentioned is now over, and the push for Vulcan Centaur is still moving forward. While SpaceX continues to share the spotlight and continues to, so far, safely put payloads in orbit. There are other smaller rockets, by the way, and other commercial payloads that are being used by the NRO and others as well. So what is the lesson of this story? The lesson of this story is that strategic priorities will change as friends become adversaries and adversaries become friends. What seemed a strategically wise approach to mitigate problems with a defeated and destitute post-Cold War Russian space sector saw its resurgence with American dollars and its pursuit of violations of numerous counterproliferation and arms control agreements on the Russian side. Thus, with the re-advent of great power competition, the push for globalization of commercial launch has subsided somewhat, and for good reason. We also had a policy, I might add, in the early 90s that pushed for use of U.S. payloads to be launched on Chinese rockets, but that's another topic for another episode. So now the U.S. has access to space for both manned civil, commercial, and national security payloads to all major orbits, and with Starship, New Glenn, and others on the horizon. The increased flight rate and satellite deployments increasing as well, it is likely that strategy will adapt and change again. But more on that in other episodes. But for now, this is Christopher Stone with Real Space Strategy. Thanks for listening. Thank you for listening to NIDS Knowledge, Real Space Strategy. The Real Space Strategy Edition is produced under NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501c3 organization dependent on donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I want to thank our producer, Kimberly Sherrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative NIDS Knowledge.